Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus. In this series, we introduce you to real people with extraordinary stories and experts who share how meditation and mindfulness practices change our lives. Our podcast is brought to you by Meditation Studio, Apple's pick as one of the 10 best apps of the year. Why download the app? Because life is messy. We get stressed, anxious, have trouble sleeping, we work too hard, we deal with conflict, our hearts get broken, we worry about the state of the world, we meditate because we're human. Our app gives you hundreds of meditations from over 30 leading experts. It helps a lot. And if you haven't tried the app yet, you can now download it for free and explore a starter series with Elisha Goldstein, plus a sample of some of our favorite guided meditations in the Discover collection. And if you've already got the app, check out our new unguided meditation timer, where you can create your own meditations with or without our brand new, pretty amazing music tracks. And don't forget the 8 free meditations on Alexa. Just ask her to enable Meditation Studio. Today's guest is Jonathan Faust, an author, photographer, and a teacher with the Insight Meditation Community of Washington, D.C. He's also the founder of the Meditation Teacher Training Institute in D.C. In this interview, he shares what it was like to grow up Quaker and then years later turn to the Buddhist teachings. He also shares some pretty great tools for dealing with anxiety using the process he writes about in his book called Body-Centered Inquiry, Meditation Training to Awaken Your Inner Guidance, Vitality, and Loving Heart. He says that when we learn to tune into our bodies, we can sense what's really going on, and this helps us to get clear about what we're feeling. Even if it's just a flicker of intuition, getting more familiar with our feelings helps us to see what's fueling our anxiety and even our anger. Jonathan is married to another well-known Buddhist teacher, one of my favorites, Tara Brach, so I couldn't help but ask him how two wise Buddhist teachers deal with conflict in their relationship. Not very gracefully, he said. But the truth is, they've learned each other's conflict styles, and that has made all the difference. There's a lot more to learn in this interview with the wise and funny Jonathan Faust. Now, here's Jonathan. Jonathan, welcome. It's so great to have you on Untangle today.
What a pleasure to have this time with you.
So I want to start with sharing a little background on you. And I know that you grew up as a Quaker and you're now a Buddhist teacher. And I'd love for you to share with our audience a little bit about what that transition was like for you.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you know, there's this great phrase the Quakers use where they say, just don't do something, sit there. So I kind of grew up with that. And they also grew up with this language around the quote unquote, still small voice within. The idea being in the sort of Quaker philosophy, if you will, that there's no intermediary between you and the divine. It's a direct relationship. So I kept hearing this, but I had no idea what the heck they were talking about. And then when I learned TM, Transcendental Meditation, when I was at a Quaker prep school, when I was 15, suddenly here was this technology that actually allowed me to really calm and cultivate that sense of inner listening. So from the first moment I discovered meditation, I knew it was going to be an important part of my life.
That's amazing. But when you say when you were as a Quaker, you're connecting with the divine, when you're meditating, do you think of that as also connecting with the divine, or is that sort of a different feeling, but you're connecting with that small, still, silent voice inside of you?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I really see that the practice of meditation is about a deep calming. I think I read somewhere, someone said prayer is talking to the divine and meditation is listening to the divine. And I think there's something about when we can calm the crazy modifications of the mind, we get to that place of inner quiet, then we truly begin to tap in more to our intuition. We just feel deeper and we're a little more in alignment. That's my sense.
And did you
come to meditation because this was sort of a natural transition for you, or were you dealing with some anxiety in your life or depression or some other sort of things that might have triggered your desire to want to be more still?
I had a pretty wild awakening when I was maybe 6 or 7. I grew up on a farm in the Pennsylvania Dutch country. And the only way, as I reflect back on it, the only way I can describe it is just a very deep awakening. So I was really intrigued by that experience. I think many people in my generation, I think part of my exploration was chemical research. But I also found that there was something about the practice of meditation and the practice of yoga that was a very direct experience. But I have to say, another aspect of my character structure was just having a deep set sense of anxiety as well. It was like a direct antidote to that.
Well, when you say a deep or a wild awakening when you were 7 or 8 years old, that's a little confusing. What was that like? I mean, confusing to be such a young child and then to have something that you would call a deep or wild awakening could be overwhelming.
I really feel that that experience dramatically shifted my life. The best way I can describe it, this little 6, 7, 8-year-old kid, I was leaning against this big pine tree, you know, behind this farmhouse. And the only way I could describe it in my little boy's brain was the sense of first merging with a tree. Like I couldn't tell any difference between the tree and myself. And then I remember using the language that the stars in the sky were like cells in my body. But here's the kicker. I have no idea how long I was in a very deep sense of reverie, of just sort of non-dual presence. And I went into the house to tell my mother, and I told her, and she looked at me and said, "Wash your hands, it's time for dinner." And it was just that sense of like, oh, no one gets this. And it set in a very deep sense of like, how come no one gets this? And why am I different? And I really do feel like that put a real burr under my saddle.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you were a very deeply spiritual person, but maybe didn't know how to define it because you were so young. And do you think that started that burr, that feeling like you were different, triggered anxiety for you?
I think so. I think part of it was the sense of like, you know, there's something here that I experienced that feels true, but no one's talking about it. No one has any language for it. If anything, there's mild to moderate annoyance when I try to talk. When I try to talk about it, there's something here in this Quaker language that kind of makes sense, but I don't see people around me really living it. And so, part of it was, I think, part of that anxiety was really that sense of belonging and purpose and all that sort of stuff. I think that really did exacerbate it for me.
Was TM your first entry into meditation and into finding people that might have understood where you were coming from a little bit more? Or was there a step before that?
I had a little taste of yoga, which was really, really powerful. Again, kind of going into the yoga nidra, into the deep relaxation, you know, feeling that brainwave shift. That was, I think this is pretty darn close. And then, of course, some, you know, chemical research, which I thought maybe this is it. And that didn't seem to be. But then when I studied transcendental meditation, I didn't know there were, I just thought that was meditation. I had no idea there were any other techniques. When I said I practiced meditation, I assumed everyone in the world practiced mantra. Mm-hmm. So for many, many years, that was my practice and I was quite dedicated to it.
But you shifted eventually to insight meditation and more breath focused.
Well, yeah. So I did mantra for about 15 years, you know, all through high school, all through college. I worked on a farm through college where we all meditated and went into the Peace Corps. And then after the Peace Corps, I stumbled into the Kripalu Yoga Ashram. Then the practice shifted. There wasn't so much of an emphasis on that form of meditation. It was a little more yoga focused. But then after about maybe 10 or 15 years there, I went out to my first Vipassana retreat and it just blew my mind.
Was that a 10-day silent retreat for you?
Yeah, was that classic 10 days, 10 hours a day, no reading, no writing, no eye contact, no yoga. it was just absolutely brutal and absolutely awakening for me.
When you were in it, did you feel it was awakening, or did you just feel brutal, brutal, brutal? And then at the end, you're like, oh, that was amazing.
I absolutely hated it.
Yeah.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling and walking I do. So comfortable for wearing anywhere. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels that you should try when you check out their website. They really feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus free ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
Let's get back to anxiety, because we're starting a new year and so many people deal with such harsh anxiety, and there are so many different types of it. And I've listened to a lot of your teachings, and I know that you focus on this, and in large part, I think you focus on it because you have had and maybe still have a bit of the experience with anxiety. So can you talk a little bit about your personal experience with anxiety, and also kind of what you teach and how you help people to find some relief?
Yeah, for me, when I began really deepening my meditation practice, one of the side benefits is there becomes more a stronger witness, you know, that there's more self-awareness. And I would notice how in the mornings, when I would wake up, there'd be these moments of just real peace and a state of consciousness, just with no desires, you know, very content. And then I would watch the software program start to boot up. And this anxiety, this thing I had to do today, what was I going to do about that? So by the time my feet hit the floor, I was in full-blown self-protection and anxiety. And I noticed, the more I began to track my own anxiety, the more I realized that it was kind of like a low-grade fever. You know, there's always something in the back of my mind that something wasn't okay. I had to keep my guard up. And over time, something really started to shift after a while. And I think one of the most insightful things for me, I went to my first month-long retreat, silent retreat, at Spirit Rock in California. And it was very dramatic. I had lots of really wonderful insights. And so I went back to do it again a couple years later, and nothing special. I had some interesting insights, but none of that dramatic low-hanging fruit I had before. So I went back to my life and re-engaged. And then my wife, Tara, one morning, she said, "Do you realize how less anxious you are?" And then I thought about it and I realized that's true. It reminded me of that phrase, that you water the root and enjoy the fruit. And there is something about the calming that can occur by taking refuge in the moment and being less caught in aversion and less caught in desire and less caught in confusion. I think that is a natural byproduct of the practice.
So you feel that when you really got to sit still for such a long period of time, it had that influence after effect?
Yeah, it did. And paradoxically, you know, as we like to joke in the meditation world, when you meditate, you'll feel better, feel mm-hmm. your anxiety better, you feel your grief better, you feel your rage better. But what I find, and for many people who really begin a practice, is you become a little bit more onto yourself. Mm-hmm. And you begin to recognize that the anxiety is a weather system. And sometimes you can just sort of just wait and it'll pass. But then, of course, there's this beautiful practice of doing a deeper investigation of the anxiety with the acronym of RAIN, when you recognize it. And the A is to ask if you can allow it or accept it. And of course, sometimes you can't, and that's okay. But then the investigation can be very, very powerful. To nourish what you find with a sense of kindness and compassion. So for me, there's a lot of juice in the investigation. And that's where I like to guide people in their own practice, to kind of have tea with that particular demon.
I like that. When you do guide people, you know, like what you're saying about the witness mind and the weather system, and it kind of gives us a little separation between our anxiety and how we can feel. You also talk about the idea of getting caught up in like that future state or the shoulds in life, which are, you know, such external pressures that we place on ourselves and we repeat over and over and over again. Is there a way to slow down the habitual anxious thinking in the moment, or is that how you would use the RAIN acronym?
Well, I think when you are visited by that particular energy or demon of anxiety, there can be something quite powerful in slowing everything down. And as they say, your issues are in your tissues. And when you can move from the story of the anxiety to really explore how you hold it on the inside, where it lives on the inside, that can be very, very powerful. And what I find for many people is when they take time to really sense, okay, so where do I feel the anxiety? Many people have trouble sort of finding its location. Because the very nature of anxiety is restless. It's just hopping from one thing to another to another. But when you really take time and inquire, so can I locate this feeling of anxiety? And quite often, people tend to feel the most in the core and the midline of the body, the mouth, the throat, the heart, the lungs, and the belly. And then really slowing down and really sensing if you can locate it and just to be with it, like you're sitting on a park bench together. Sometimes that alone creates a little bit of a shift. And inevitably, if someone can really sort of in touch with how it lives on the inside, I might ask them, is there a sense of how old this is? And quite often people they'll say, oh, this is, this is from 6 or 7 years old, or like this feeling of anxiety, I don't even know what it's like being without it. That's how old it is. And that's so helpful to really see that, how deep that clench of anxiety can be held. And then, of course, the practice is to, the end part of that equation is really to inquire, can you nourish what you find with a sense of empathy or kindness or compassion? I was recently in a conversation with a meditation teacher who was saying how, in his experience, one of the most direct ways of working with anxiety is to recognize it, to ask if you can be with it, to pause, to really investigate where it lives on the inside, to sense how old it is. And quite often, it's really quite young. Mm. And then to take that young little being and just hold that little young being on your lap and sense what that little person needs and offer them some reassurance or kindness. And quite often when I ask people, well, what does that felt sense feeling of anxiety need? A lot of people will say, you know, this is surprising. It doesn't need love. It doesn't need nurturing. It just needs to be acknowledged. And then just by acknowledging or letting it know they see it, there's something, you know, that we experience as a felt shift. And that might be a sense of calming or a dispersing of that felt sense of anxiety. Sometimes it can be a lifting. Sometimes there can even be a feeling of elation that comes just from letting it know you see it.
Is this your body-centered inquiry process? And you've written a whole book on this. And is that when you like sort of identifying the felt sense that you're referring?
Yeah. And it's really recognizing. And what I love about this work, and this is really inspired by a man named Dr. Eugene Gendlin, who created something called focusing, which in its time was absolutely revolutionary. And I think one of the reasons why focusing isn't so well known is because it really informed somatic psychology in such a way that his work really became absorbed. This is a story I like to tell that he tells. When he was working on his PhD in psychology, after his PhD in philosophy, he was watching a woman doing a therapeutic process. And this woman said, I am so angry with my sister. And then she stopped and she closed her eyes and she said, no, that's not it. I'm disappointed with my sister. Mm-hmm. And he thought, what happened there? Here's a story in the mind. I'm angry. But then once you checked in with the body, that word didn't match the feeling. And when she really was able to acknowledge the disappointment, that was much closer to the truth of what her actual experience was. So I find that just as in Buddhist practice, we talk of the four foundations of awareness, that we have this experience of just raw, undifferentiated energy, and then that arises into vedana, to pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Then we hop right into a thought form, you know, I don't like this, or a story. When we can really slow things down and explore, well, this particular repetitive thought, or this obsessive thought, or this strong emotion, can I locate it on the inside? There's a very deep transformative possibility of coming in contact with it in its real location of its genesis.
Is it hard for people to identify that feeling? I think in some of your work, I've seen sometimes when it's really strong, there's a lump in your throat or you feel something that is more dramatic. What about for those of us that don't feel that sort of strong feeling?
Yeah, it's a training. It's a challenge. And as I like to joke, pretty much the first 25 years of my life, I thought the only reason I had a body was to make my head portable.
Yeah.
We're so disassociated. We're so cut off from the body. But I think this may be helpful. It certainly has been for me. That when you begin to tune in to how the issues are in your tissues, there are three different categories of how you'll experience what we call the felt sense. And one of them is strong and unmistakable. You can't miss it. You know, that's the lump in your throat. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the burning around your eyes like you're about to cry. It's that ache in your heart. It's that sick, twisted feeling in your guts like something horrible is going to happen. That's one category. You can't miss it. The other way is if you look at it, it's very much like when you're having thoughts in meditation, they come and go. So like that feeling it'll come as like a little flicker or a blip or a wave. And then you'll be doing your inquiry and you'll be like, oh, wow, a little wave of sadness went through, but I'm looking for it and I can't find it. So it'll be that quality of like flickering. But the third quality, and this is where it's very, very helpful to really slow down and sense what's there, is that feeling will be vague and unformed and amorphous. And so the magic word is something. So it may be like, okay, so when I think about this breakup I just went through, when I really investigate my story around it, there's something really heavy over my heart. Mm. You know, there's something here that feels like gray and leaden in my belly. And sometimes by really paying attention to that sort of vague and amorphous, the willingness to hang out there right on that edge between what you're aware of and what you're just becoming aware of, there can be some very rich insights.
Mm, yeah, that's so good for people to hear, because not everybody has the strong and undeniable feeling. So it's really nice to know that we can slow down and really kind of tune in to these different, more vague senses.
And I think part of the key is to really draw on your own sincerity when you're doing that investigation. You know, when you're beset by anxiety or worry or restlessness, or there's something that feels undigested, just this sincere desire to really get to know it. And there's a little phrase that I just love.
And this show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you've ever thought about therapy and haven't quite jumped in yet, it may be the right time to explore BetterHelp. Whether you're looking for new coping skills or to improve a relationship, or maybe dealing with some social anxiety or just need to recharge your batteries so you can be the best version of yourself, therapy is great. And this could be just the right time to give BetterHelp a shot. Finding a therapist through BetterHelp is easy. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and they do their best to match you with a licensed therapist that's a great fit for you. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now, back to our show.
That is to substitute the words, I'm going to fix this, with the words, I'm going to get familiar with this. Mm. And there's a world of difference between the two. Because, I believe the Buddha said that familiarity leads to wisdom. that when you allow yourself to just to get a little more familiar with this whole situation, that can create a very profound shift.
Yeah. I mean, I think about that in terms of emotional or physical pain. And when we push it away or, you know, hide it or resist it, it always sort of stays and feels worse. And this idea of getting to know it and maybe looking at it a little bit differently can have a really nice impact.
Yeah, the willingness to sit down and have tea with it.
Yeah.
And maybe even to sort of imagine that it actually might be wanting to teach you something, that there may be some kind of lesson in here, can be a very helpful way to look at it.
Yeah. So let's talk about something that's a little more volatile, I think, for a lot of people, and that's dealing with anger. You know, I'd love to know how to use some of these tools with that, because I think sometimes there are these little angers that nestle inside of us and come out in passive aggressive ways. And then there are the big angers that maybe come from what you talk about as our unmet needs. Will you talk a little bit about that and how to use some of these tools to maybe, is it regulate our anger or is it get friendly with our anger?
Yeah, again, it's a willingness to get familiar with it. But you know that movie, Analyze This, with Robert De Niro and
Blake Bortles? Yeah.
Where at some point, like, Robert De Niro is having an anger attack and he's just saying over and over again, anger is an unmet need. Anger is an unmet need.
No.
Anger is an unmet need. It's absolutely true.
Yeah.
That whenever you are angry, there's always something you're wanting or something you're hoping for that didn't happen. And to me, that's just one of the keys of really getting underneath the anger. And oftentimes it requires some kind of brutal honesty. So what was, oh my God, yeah, I was really wanting some attention and I didn't get it.
Yeah.
Or I was really wanting to be, you know, really wanting this person to respond this way and it didn't happen.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really, really great way to diffuse it. And I think I've kind of gotten in the habit of doing that for myself. The other thing too, though, is that what I find is that most of us are really afraid of our own anger. And part of it is that we're afraid of being out of control and we're afraid of the damage that we might do if that anger was really full blown. And so this is where it's really important that we have the right environment in which to really investigate anger. But I find in meditation, again, when you practice that RAIN acronym, you know, you recognize, okay, here's the weather system of anger, you know, thunderstorms and hurricanes and typhoons. And then you ask, can I allow it? Can I accept it? And again, sometimes you can't. You just feel flooded. You just don't have the energy or don't have the, you know, the mindfulness. You don't have the all the conditions to really be with it. And then it's very skillful to let it know you see it and turn your attention elsewhere. But if you can be with it, it's a very interesting thing to investigate, because I love how the word emotion, it's emotion, it's energy in motion.
Ooh.
And just how, like, when, as I often say to people, you ever notice how much housework you can get when you're pissed? You get so much done.
Right.
Because you've got all that energy. So then it's like, well, can you really, really explore that energy? And one of the things, and again, it's only when the conditions are right, you can ask yourself, okay, how big could this energy get?
Oh, I see.
And that becomes fascinating, because then let it, you know, and let it just burn down buildings and burn down cities and then just see what might be behind it when it gets to flame out a little bit. And oftentimes underneath it will be a deep tenderness. Mm. Oftentimes there's disappointment, there's hurt, there's a deeper insight into the unmet need. There can be shame. There can be so much that what we call anger, I really think of as really a tangle of all these other emotions. And then again, can you meet that with some sense of empathy and kindness and compassion?
Yeah. Oh, that's such a rich, rich insight. And we talk about sitting and, you know, kind of doing this process with ourselves. How do we bring this to the person or to the event that we're angry at with kindness and compassion? And, you know, you're an expert in this area, but you're married.
to one of the top meditation teachers in the country. You're both one of the top thought leaders. You're both top teachers. How do the two of you sit down and deal with conflict after you've worked through this on your own?
Sometimes not very gracefully. There's your own personal dharma, like your own path. But then when you explore relational dharma, it gets complicated really fast.
Yes, yes.
But we were once, early on in our marriage, we had a sense of like mutual needs not being met. And we both kind of got triggered by our own patterns. And my pattern is when there's conflict, I tend to get avoidant. You know, I tend to withdraw. Mm-hmm. And for Tara, when things aren't going her way, she'll lean in with a little more aggression. And so we were kind of getting into a pretty rotten pattern where she would feel kind of an unmet need of some kind. And it would sort of show up as being a little aggressive or judgmental. And then I would just do my conflict avoidant thing, which would just escalate the whole situation. And finally, we were talking, you know, again, this is pretty early in our relationship. And I was upset about something and I didn't speak up, as is my style. And so finally, it just came out in a really unskillful way, my whole perception of something. And I just blurted it out. And then she said, I totally get it. I would feel exactly the same way if that was me. And then suddenly, game over. It completely dissipated my entire story because it was suddenly seen and heard and acknowledged. And in that same way, when she would be upset, and I could really develop some empathy and really get what it was like for her and acknowledge that, again, it would very quickly dissipate. So now we have a joke where we say the first person to do a role reversal wins. And actually, you know, that really is the key I have found, is the capacity to feel what another person is feeling really is key to healing the natural rifts that show up in relationship.
Do you think that our practice of meditation and loving kindness tools and compassion practices help with this? In addition, I'm just wondering, like, I think a lot of people maybe don't even talk about their anger style. So I think while you may not always deal with your situation gracefully, at least you understand each other's anger styles. You may not always acknowledge or communicate them, but at least you have that foundation.
Well, as Harville Hendricks, who sort of a relationships guru, famously said, romantic love is the anesthesia that brings two incompatible people together for the purpose of healing.
Oh, gosh.
You know, so, you know, we just get caught. We lose it all the time.
Right.
But I do find, and again, I'm not so crazy about the word mindfulness. Mm-hmm. I much prefer the term non-judging awareness. That when we practice non-judging awareness or the byproduct of meditation, we become more aware. And that means we become more self-aware and we become aware of others. But I have been so inspired by nonviolent communication as a really powerful tool. And I like to think of it in terms of four questions whenever there's conflict, you know, or when you're working with anger in relationship. The first one is, what do we both agree we're talking about? And when you ask yourself that question, you have to role reverse, because you have to imagine how the other person would describe it and make sure you're in agreement. So it's not, remember when you walked out of the dining room this morning like the narcissistic jerk you are? That's not going to fly. So identifying that observable behavior. And then the second question, and these are so simple, but they go so deep. The second question is, what do I feel? And it's never just one feeling. And that leads to the third question, which is, what was I hoping for? What was I wanting? And what I find is if I can get really honest about that one, I've just eliminated blame. It's taking 100% responsibility for myself. And then the fourth question is, well, what is a life-affirming request? What is something I could ask that would continue the conversation, such as, would you be willing to find a time to talk about this? Mm. Would you be willing to tell me what it's like from your perspective? And I really do find that it takes real courage to explore where we are stuck, you know, to investigate anything that's between you and feeling free. Mm-hmm. That takes such courage. And then in the relational field, when it's charged, we need every tool we can get our hands on.
Right. Yeah. Someone I interviewed used the term that love is living messily ever after versus happily ever after, which I thought was good.
I think that's quite apt.
Really quite did. Apt, right? Yeah. Well, I think I'd love for you to come back on our show and focus fully on communication, love, and relationships, because it sounds like there's a lot here and there's a lot that we all have to learn.
Well, I for one, am a perpetual student in this department.
Right? Okay, good. Well, let's do that then.
That sounds great.
Yeah, Jonathan, thank you so much for being with us today. This has really been rich with insight and inspiration, and I am 100% committed to having you back on our show because I feel like there's so much more here.
Well, I'm so happy to connect with you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much to Jonathan for being on our show today. For more information on his book, retreats, or workshops, check out jonathanfaust.com. If you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at patricia@meditationstudioapp.com. And don't forget to download Meditation Studio in the App Store or listen to the meditations on Alexa. We'll see you next time.